Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here, and we're trying something new, packaging three of our favorite segments from the week for you to listen to on the weekend in case you missed them. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Have a great weekend. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. When Bette Midler was here last week, in addition to talking about showbiz and New York in the 80s and stuff like that, one of the things that came up was a letter she wrote opposing the height of a proposed office building in Englewood Cliffs.
The Rockefeller family deeded the Cloisters Museum and Fort Tryon Park and bought the Palisades across from the Cloisters so that the view would be unspoiled. It was all a package, and it was a family package, and it was given to the city, to the state of New York, and to the city of New York, and to the state of New York, and the state of New Jersey. And it was kind of an unwritten agreement. The Palisades part was an unwritten agreement, and all the towns around the Palisades have sort of held on to that code for, you know, since it was given in the late 30s. And it's very, very beautiful.
Bette Midler on our show last week. Let's follow up. And here's the issue. The electronics company LG wants to be the first to build above the tree line along the Palisades Cliffs there north of the George Washington Bridge. LG and the mayor of Englewood Cliffs tout thousands of jobs. But building that high would mar the pristine view from the New York side. Opposition in New Jersey is also strong. Four past governors, two Democrats, two Republicans, have come out against breaching the tree line. We'll talk to former Governor Christy Whitman in just a minute. Six mayors in neighboring New Jersey localities have also come out opposed. Alpine, Tenafly, Cluster, and Harrington Park have joined a lawsuit against the building, as have environmental groups on both sides of the river. We will speak to an LG company official after we hear from former Governor Christy Whitman, also former U.S. EPA administrator, co-chair of CAS Energy Coalition, a nuclear power advocacy group, and president of the Whitman Strategy Group. Governor, thanks for coming on, and welcome back to WNYC.
My pleasure. It's always good to be with you, Brian.
So you and Tom Kane and Brendan Byrne and Jim Florio sent a letter opposing LG's plan. Why are you getting involved?
Well, because this is an important part of our pristine environment, something that's enjoyed by both sides of the river. It's been respected. The land's been set aside. And the height restriction, while not in law, has been respected forever. And it's not a question of building or not building. They have a 27-acre track, LG, and they can go sideways. They don't have to build this 143-foot-tall building, which would stick up some 80 feet above the trees and would be visible from all directions. And, in fact, they said that they want to have that height so they can enjoy the view, which gets in everybody else's view, and their own architect acknowledged at one of the hearings that they had enough space to take the entire building and put it on its side. So we as former governors are very sensitive to the jobs issue and the economic issue, and LG has been a good corporate citizen. But in this instance, we hope that they will reconsider and do what we would argue would be the right thing for everyone involved and keep this area, which is so special. I mean, you know, if you think about it, these cliffs were formed 200 million years ago, and it was more than a century ago that New Jersey and New York created the Palisade Interstate Park to protect the scenic beauty. And then it was extended, and the height restriction was kind of observed by everybody because of the importance of an unrestricted view of green and open space.
On the view, some supporters of the LG building say this is a New York versus New Jersey thing, a New York selfishness issue. So people who drive the Henry Hudson or live in Upper Manhattan or Riverdale or Westchester want their nice little view. But if thousands of New Jersey jobs are at stake, too bad priorities. And by the way, full disclosure, I live in Inwood, though my building is inland and does not have a river view. But why would you oppose this as a New Jerseyan rather than seeing it as New Jersey's right to develop versus New York's right to a view across the river?
Well, first of all, again, it is not at the cost of all those jobs. They could lay the building on its side, create the same amount of space for their employees, and just not ruin that particular area. And frankly, you know, once we start breaking these barriers and breaking down environmental protections that we've put in place, because ambiance is both sides of the river, and having that, not having great buildings sticking out, even if you can't see the river, if you're further back in New Jersey, you can look out over the tops of the trees, and all of a sudden there's this building 80 feet above anything else sticking up. That's a scenic view that's ruined on both sides of the river, and we care about this as being something that has been felt over the past by both states to be worthy of preservation, and we want to keep it that way.
LG argues that it's an environmental versus environmental trade-off, and as it was put in NorthJersey.com the other day, LG officials have said that by building up rather than out, as you just suggested, the amount of green space on the property can be increased and impervious coverage can be minimized. And they say the thin design of the building, if it goes up rather than out, will also conserve energy because more natural light will be able to enter the building. So do they have a point, in your opinion, that there are environmental arguments on either side of this?
Yeah, they do. There's no question about it, because the more land that you put cover imperviously, the less space there is for runoff. But there's a lot they can do around it and design around it to minimize even that impact. And you can make energy-efficient buildings that go sideways. I mean, there are a lot of LEED buildings. You can do a LEED Platinum building on that site. That takes a commitment by the company to do it. And it's one of the reasons why you have all the environmental groups on both sides of the river, or most of the environmental groups on both sides of the river, opposing this. They understand that there are trade-offs. And, yes, LG does have a point there. You can't say that they don't. But on the other side argues, we think those arguments are more persuasive.
The website...
It's an interstate park and a celebrated national landmark, and we hope that they will take the time and take another look and redesign.
And it's not just about this one building. The website homepage for the group Protect the Palisades, which is opposing the building, has an animation of what they imagine would happen once the tree line is breached by one developer. You can see the eventual development in this animation of an ugly high-rise building skyline over the cliffs, reaching higher and higher after the precedent is set by LG, that the natural view doesn't matter anymore, and the zoning allows for higher and higher buildings from the GW Bridge all the way up to Bear Mountain. Do you think that's what's at stake here ultimately?
I think so, because it's going to be very hard to say no to the next developer who wants to go up. You've set a precedent. You've allowed for this now. And so once you've done that, you're in real legal jeopardy in trying to deny the next developer from going up, and those are beautiful sites. If you put apartments up there, they don't look at themselves. They look across the river, so it's beautiful for them, and people will want to buy apartments that have that kind of view. So I can see developers looking at this as a prime area for development and sticking buildings up, and they'd want to go up so they'd have that view. But it's that kind of a trade-off that weighs in favor, in our minds, of asking LG to please put this building on its side, do the right thing, preserve this very, very precious and special part of our environment, and not be the first to break this uncodified respect for the environment and the view.
Why should these cliffs be kept pristine when the cliffs below the bridge have been open to development? This is one of LG's arguments. There are plenty of tall buildings higher than theirs that go all down along the cliffs below the bridge. So why should we see this area as somehow sacrosanct?
Because it has been preserved over time. It's been a long time since we put these, the Palisade Parkway was created, and that's about like arguing, well, why do we bother with any kind of natural park? I mean, we can build everywhere just because somebody's built next door. Let's keep on building. And that is a counterintuitive argument if you care about quality of life. And quality of life is more than just as many jobs or as many people as you can squeeze into a space. People need open space. The trees do a job for us in cleaning our air. Open space is good for us, and the development below the cliffs are not visible in the sense that this would be sticking up like a thumb in the middle of a green swath that would stick out and be very, very visible to everybody and then would be the beginning, I believe, of the end. But to say just because they build in other places and it's okay to start building here doesn't make any sense.
You mentioned that keeping development below the tree line is not codified in law. It's more a tradition. And this is in court over the zoning variance that Englewood Cliffs granted. The height limit is generally 35 feet there for exactly this reason. Englewood Cliffs approved a variance allowing LG to build four times that high, 143 feet. You said that would be 80 feet above the tree line. And I'm surprised Englewood Cliffs has the power to do that unilaterally rather than some larger compact governing the Palisades. But I guess no one ever developed one. Do you have a comment on the legal question in addition to whether it's just a good idea or not? Can a court actually stop this?
I would think a court probably could, but I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. So I don't know, you know, what the legal parameters would be here. I would just hope. That's why we as four governors wrote to the company initially. We did not get a response from headquarters, but we did get a response from the representative here in the United States, and it was a pretty dismissive response, I thought, the four former governors. But, you know, hey, everybody does it their own way. But what they said was they dismissed the fact that they said it wouldn't, the building wouldn't rise above the tree line. Well, it does. Clearly does. We've done all the everybody who's focused on this have done all the schematics, and there's no question it will be above the tree line. And they do. Their own architect have said they could achieve the same thing by laying the building on its side. And if they want to take, they're deciding to build the tower when they. Their first arguments in building it as a tower had nothing to do with preserving the penetrable land. It was about taking advantage of the beauty of the site and the view of the site, which means that they want it for their own private benefits, the natural beauty of the Palisades. And those unspoiled views are for everybody.
Governor Whitman, before you go and we bring on an LG vice president, if I could get you briefly on a related matter. Governor Christie recently characterized the relationship between New York and New Jersey as like the Hatfields versus the McCoys regarding the Port Authority and the George Washington Bridge mess. Was it like that during your time as governor, or do you think the Port Authority has become more dysfunctional, more of a patronage mill, especially for New Jersey?
Well, there were always tensions, and there were always arguments as to who was getting more money and which project, and that's why you have a chairman from one state and the executive director from another state, and then we put in a deputy executive director so that we in New Jersey would have a little more say, because it's really the executive director that makes those decisions, not so much the chairman, and we wanted to make sure that we were at the table. But, you know, you work them out. It's functioned well for a long time. Has it changed? It seems apparently that there are a lot more positions that have been added to it. Whether they were all necessary or not, I don't know. But you've got to always be watchful of that and be careful that you don't try to use it as a patronage, just a pork barrel entity, because it does serve a very important function, and it's the best way to try to keep the states working together and to understand that what happens on one side of the river does affect the other, both for good and ill.
Do you regret creating that position of deputy executive director considering recent events?
No, I don't, because at the time there was no question. The history had shown that, in fact, it was the executive director that directed where most of the money went. Fortunately, I also appointed a very strong chairman who kept on top of things and watched things very carefully, but the chairman is not a full-time position, and it's with most companies, if you're not there day in and day out, you don't know how all the money's being spent. You know what they tell you, and you can sniff when you think something is not quite as it should be, but you need somebody who's there day to day, and that's what that position allowed us to have.
Christy Todd Whitman, former New Jersey governor and U.S. EPA administrator, co-chair of CAS Energy Coalition, a nuclear power advocacy group, and president of the Whitman Strategy Group. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're talking about the increasingly contentious proposal by the company LG to build a corporate headquarters that would be the first structure to break the tree line of the Palisades north of the George Washington Bridge, 143 feet rather than 35 feet high, the max that has been observed in the past. With us now is John Taylor, Vice President of Public Affairs for LG Electronics USA. Mr. Taylor, thanks a lot for coming on. And you've been listening to Governor Whitman. How would you like to begin your response?
Well, with all due respect to the governor, I think she is passionate about this topic. LG Electronics is proud of this project. We have been residents of and good corporate citizens of Englewood Cliffs for 25 years. The Palisades represent an important part of the fabric of our community. On the New Jersey side, we love the Palisades and would never do anything to harm them. I think there's a misperception about this so-called tower. It's not a tower by any measure. It's a green corporate campus, the north wing of which happens to be 8 stories. It's not going to tower above the Palisades, and in fact, it's not the first building that will jut above the tree line, St. Peter's University to the north.
Do you disagree with the stat from Governor Whitman of 80 feet above tree line?
It depends. That sight line depends on where you're measuring it from. If you're at the river level, you won't see anything. If you're in a high rise in Manhattan looking down, you will see some things. If you're at the Cloisters, it will barely peak above the tree line. And I would add that the building is designed, you know, despite some of the misleading renderings you'll see, the building is designed to blend into the environment, to reflect the surroundings and the sky.
How does it feel, though, to be the first to break with the environmentalist tradition that Governor Whitman was talking about, that even though this hasn't been codified in law, there has been an unwritten code that you don't build above that tree line? Does it bother you at all?
Well, we're not the first to build above the tree line. The precedent has been set, Brian. There are just a half mile to the south in Fort Lee. There are quite a few tall buildings. In fact, two new 40-story buildings going in right now.
But I asked Governor Whitman that question, and she said, look, this is where the open space tradition has been established, above the bridge, above Fort Lee. And so your company is looking to breach that.
We are building an environmentally sound building that is going to actually protect the Palisades. It's going to reduce runoff into the Palisades. And as the governor pointed out, you know, we're going to increase the green space. We're actually planting 700 trees on the site with additional buffers, so those along the trails will continue to enjoy their uninterrupted view along the trails.
How do you define community at LG? Is each worker in his cubicle an island unto himself?
This project enjoys very strong support from the local community in Englewood Cliffs. They recognize the economic and environmental impact of this project.
The local community in Englewood Cliffs, but not by its neighbors in New Jersey and in New York. I mean, if one employee at his cubicle wants to mount a poster that rises over all the other cubicles and lots of the workers in the cubicles near his object, would you allow it?
I'm not sure that's a fair analogy, and I probably understated the amount of support throughout Bergen County. This project was strongly supported by the Bergen County Executive, unanimous vote of the Bergen County Board of Freeholders, a bipartisan support, recognizing the economic impact and the environmental impact of this project.
But that's what you have. You have the County Executive, and you have Englewood Cliffs, and all the other neighbors are opposed to it on both sides of the river. And is that enough for you? Are you really comfortable with that? Is that the kind of corporate citizen you want to be?
Well, we've been very accommodating to the community and listening. You know, this has been a process, Brian, that's been underway for 7 years. LG started in 2008 looking for a new location for our corporate headquarters based on the expected growth of our company. We explored over 200 sites around the country. And then in 2009, when we were able to purchase this property in our own backyard, a perfect site for us, we embarked on a design that would complement the community and be an environmental showcase for the whole state.
It didn't work.
There were six very public hearings during 2011, during which we made multiple adjustments to the overall plan.
It didn't work, considering the extent of the opposition, right?
The opposition showed up at the 11th hour. We're at the stage now. We've got to take occupancy in 2017. Our company is growing fast. We're consolidating operations. And this is going to allow us to increase our employment in Englewood Cliffs from about 500 today to 1,200 by 2017 and 1,600 by 2020.
Governor Whitman says you can build out and have all those jobs instead of up.
Would it be possible to build it shorter and fatter? Indeed. But the opposition would lead you to believe that that's a simple matter. It will take years to go down that path, redesigning the building, going through all of the approval processes again. And that, frankly, will not meet our business needs, but also is not good for the state of New Jersey. It will delay the economic benefits of creating over 2,200 construction jobs, much-needed construction jobs here in the short term.
And do you not care about the New York side at all? State Senator Jeff Klein, who represents the Bronx and Westchester shoreline communities there, calls the Palisades a nationally recognized treasure shared by two states. New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman says the Palisades Park was jointly created more than 100 years ago for the express purpose of preserving magnificent views for millions of people in New York and New Jersey. Speaking for Governor Cuomo, the New York State Parks Commissioner wrote you a letter saying the proposed height of the building would be incompatible with the natural landscape. Does none of that New York argument matter to you?
Well, what it boils down to, Brian, is the view from across the river versus this economic engine of this project and the need for us to move forward. We understand their views, so to speak, but we're moving forward as planned.
If all you're talking about is delay, the same construction jobs would be there a couple of years from now, that would be there a couple of months from now, and so it's a net wash, isn't it? And then you'd have a lot more people happy with you as a corporate citizen.
I'll let you talk to those in organized labor about whether it's a net wash to wait another 2 years to create these jobs. This is a really crucial time for our country and for the state of New Jersey to start to rebuild employment.
And when you say you're going ahead with your business plan, I guess you have to wait for the court ruling. But if they
Not necessarily, Brian.
Go ahead.
I'm not a lawyer either, or the governor said she wasn't, but I understand the legal process. The New Jersey State Supreme Court or State Superior Court reaffirmed the approval last year. There's an appeal underway right now. We respect the appeal process, but we firmly believe that in the end, the appeals court will find that the trial court ruled properly based on the law.
But you said you don't necessarily have to wait for the court ruling. You're going to start building up rather than out before they decide?
Work is underway at the site as we speak. The demolition of the existing property began in last November and will be ramping up this spring to be completed later this summer, with the construction to begin later this year.
What if the court rules against you?
We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Again, we are confident that the appeals court will find that the trial court made the right decision.
John Taylor, Vice President of Public Affairs for LG Electronics USA. We heard earlier from former Governor Christine Todd Whitman. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And listeners, you can post your comments on this to our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer.
It's the
Lehrer
Brian Show. Lehrer
Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With us now, Biz Stone, co-founder of Twitter, and maybe you're using his new social media question and answer site, Jelly, which he says is designed not just to provide answers, but to increase empathy in the world. Can that really happen? And Biz Stone has a new book called Things a Little Bird Told Me, Confessions of the Creative Mind. Biz Stone, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Oh, thanks, Brian. I appreciate you having me.
And listeners, you can call, post to our comments page, or tweet any questions for Biz Stone right now. Tweet at Brian Lehrer. Use the hashtag AskBiz, and maybe we'll increase global empathy along the way. Who knows? And seriously, let me jump in right at that conceptual level, because you write in the book that the real reason humanity has become so hyperconnected is not about playing games or keeping tabs on friends. The true promise of a connected society is people helping one another, your sentence. So is that the sentimental view of someone who's already made your digital fortune, or did you have that in mind the whole time when you conceived of Twitter and other early things that you've done?
I wouldn't say that I had it in mind the whole time. It's more of a – there's an author named Steven Johnson, and he writes about something called the slow hunch. It's this concept that there's something in the back of your brain sort of the whole time you're working, and it doesn't really come out and sort of reveal itself to you until many, many years later. So I would say that maybe in the back of my mind all this time, yes. But it wasn't until I left day-to-day operations at Twitter and began kind of noodling – around and thinking about things, getting a little bit less, a little less boots on the ground and a little bit more philosophical about things, did I realize that perhaps all of this is headed in a direction for a reason bigger than the sum of its parts.
And along these lines, you write that Jelly, your new Q&A social media site, is less about helping the askers get information than it is about helping the answerers get an empathy fix. Is it really?
Actually, the numbers show that to be true. There's far more people willing to answer questions than there are people willing to ask. Where we're constrained is the number of questions coming in. So you'd think it would be the other way around. You'd think that people would just ask a question and not get an answer, but in fact, you're more likely to get an answer than you are to get a question on the system. And that's because people are just wired to help. We're wired to help other people. And the only reason we don't do it is because pulling over on the side of the freeway and helping someone change a tire, that's a whole difficult thing. And we make excuses for not doing it, like the guy might be crazy, they probably have AAA, they probably already called a friend. If I stop, I'll just be a nuisance. But if we create a system that just lets you tap on, a piece of glass you're holding in your hand, your smartphone, and answer the question or forward it to somebody who might know, I mean, that's you're being no less helpful in some cases, and you're getting the reward, you're getting the thank you card, you're getting that feedback loop from another person that says, hey, thank you for thinking of me, thank you for helping me, and that's really important for people to feel that.
Let me read a piece of pushback to this idea from a commenter on TechCrunch who had read your description of Jelly. And in a way, this is a pushback to the larger notion that social media can help connect people across socioeconomic lines and work as a leveler. A writer named Gil Reich asks, in what world does a 14-year-old girl in Florida get a professional answer from an art director? In a world where it's shared by her rich uncle and powerful uncle who has many others trying to do him favors and get his attention, which may be okay, he writes, but don't claim you're doing it in the name of global empathy. He says, if this were really for global empathy, the influential and well-connected networks would be deployed not to help each other, but to answer the questions of those furthest from their networks. Do you struggle with anything like that?
No, I don't struggle with it. And again, I wouldn't say that my main effort here is necessarily global empathy. I think this is an incredible, wonderful side effect of what we're building. What we're building is we've designed a better way to ask a question. And no one's really rethought this system in the last 15 years. No one's completely reimagined the way we get answers to our queries in the last 15 years because everything's been working so good. But we do live in a completely different media landscape now. We all have these connected mobile devices. We're all on social networks. There's the new degree of separation is no longer 6. It's now been marked down to 3.8, so 4 degrees of separation. We live in a whole new world, and so when you reimagine this way we get our answers, the way my co-founder and I did, we came up with this idea that everyone's connected. We should be able to ask one another for the answers to our questions, not just machines.
And by the way, listeners, if you like that idea, stay tuned for our latest edition of Brian Lehrer Advice Roulette. Later this hour, we're going to do a Equal Pay Day edition of Advice Roulette. This is Equal Pay Day with respect to gender disparities in how much people are paid. And we're going to have women callers ask other women callers workplace advice roulette coming up in about 40 minutes. But right now we continue with Biz Stone, co-founder of Twitter and author of a new book, Things a Little Bird Told Me, Confessions of the Creative Mind. And if you want to talk to Biz Stone, call us up, 212-433-WNYC. We'll read some of the questions that you've been tweeting for him along the way, but our phones are also open, 212-433-9692 on WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River, New York and New Jersey Public Radio. So Biz, Twitter just turned 8 years old, as I don't have to tell you. And in the book, you give a little prehistory of Twitter, saying that as far back as 2003, you set your RSS reader, for people who don't know, that's the content feed of some sites people followed, to 255 characters. Of course, Twitter is 140. But you said even in 2003, maybe 255 would become a new standard for blogs. Why that number at that time?
Actually, I didn't set it. It was, at the time, RSS reader, I think it was this, they had standardized the summary of what is going to go in the reader at 255 characters. Somebody had picked that, and they went with it. And I thought to myself, maybe in a world, I think it might have even been 2002, but I said maybe in a world later on, I visualized a world where we were all reading these things on I saw my iPod, my first generation iPod, and I thought, why can't I read things on this, little articles, and maybe they'd be better suited if they were shorter. So I just sort of threw that idea out there, which is frequently what I did with my blog back in the day.
So how did you land on 140 characters for Twitter?
So the way we landed on 140 characters is that when we were building Twitter, we wanted tweets to be both consumed and created in their entirety on everything from the lowliest feature phone to the fanciest broadband-connected web browser. And the international limit for text messages is 160 characters. Nowadays, we don't notice it because our smartphones stitch them together, and, yep, and we don't see that. But the limit is 160, and so we were operating within that limit, and we needed, of course, to give room for the author's name. So that meant, okay, 160 minus some number for the author's name. So we actually chose 15 characters for the author's name, and the rest of the 140 for the tweet, which, of course, then leaves 5 characters unused, which is kind of funny, but that's where we got to 140. We just didn't, originally in the prototype, it was 160 minus however long your name was. But then I brought up to Jack that I didn't think that was fair, that my name is 3 letters long, someone else's name might be Jonathan, and then they have less to tweet with, so why don't we just pick a number?
And you're right that you worried, as you were launching, that Twitter would not be useful. Were you concerned that it would just be a platform for trivial content and pointless snark if it was all messages that short?
Well, yeah, at first it just seemed like it was fun. And to be frank, at first that was enough, because the company we had just been trying to work on wasn't fun for us. We weren't having fun. We weren't what I call emotionally invested. We didn't use our own product. And so when we started building Twitter, things started to happen right off the bat, even in the prototyping phase. I decided that I had watched enough Bob Vila when I was a kid that I could do a little home improvement on this little house my wife and I had bought in Berkeley. It was a heat wave, and I thought, oh, I'll just rip up the carpeting and reveal the beautiful hardwood floors underneath like they used to do.
This old social media platform.
Yeah, right. And of course, I start ripping up the carpeting, and there's just a subfloor. I've ruined my home. And I get a tweet at the same time from Evan Williams, our other co-founder, and it says, sipping Pinot Noir after a massage in Napa Valley. And I just start laughing out loud at the incongruence of our two, you know, states at this moment. And then I realize I'm laughing out loud. This is fantastic. I'm laughing at something I'm working on. And this is joy, and this is wonderful. And so at first, that's really all I needed to keep going. It wasn't until later that I realized that this platform could be important.
Could be important?
Yeah, Later on, I learned that there was a few little lessons that sort of kind of piqued my interest, but then there was a real watershed moment that told me, without a doubt, that this could be an important platform.
So were you shocked after you created this thing for fun, tweeting that you were sipping pina coladas while getting a massage or whatever you said your partner did? Did you ever imagine that, like, by 2009, a people's revolt in Iran could come to be nicknamed a Twitter revolution? Or was that just beyond your wildest dreams and you were, you know, gobsmacked when it happened?
Oh, it definitely was something that took us by surprise. But again, I had a history of building these large-scale systems where people are allowed to, you know, express themselves and communicate. I started in 1999 with an early blogging network. I went on to work at Google on Blogger. So I had seen what an unrestrained platform for freedom of speech can, you know, what kind of impacts it can have. Except Twitter sort of blew it all away because it was so accessible. The barrier for entry was so low. It definitely really just took us by surprise. We were amazed. We had to just keep reminding ourselves, it's not Twitter. It's not the tools we're building. It's the brave men and women around the world and what they're doing, and they're choosing to use this tool. They would, if we didn't build this tool, they would use some other tool. So we just had to keep reminding ourselves of that.
So one of our followers at Kitson asks you about, quote, USAID's Cuban Twitter, imitation, sincerest form of insurgency, goes that tweet. And for people who don't know about it, this is in today's news. We have the U.S. government planting a social media site in Cuba, being compared to Twitter in its essence, but designed to help track and really foment political opposition to the government there. Are you flattered, outraged, anything by this?
Actually, maybe I would say validated, just because I spent so much time and energy making sure that people understood that Twitter was – the decisions we made at Twitter were not affected by any part of the U.S. government or any other government. I never wanted anyone to think that we were – you know, we had some, like, red phone hotline that we responded to. When we made decisions, we made them because we thought they were the best thing at the time for the people who were using Twitter, not because anyone, emailed us or called us or anything like that. So I always steered clear of any, like, hey, look, come in, you know, we invite you to come, like, to the White House and get photographed with, you know, that's all great, but I didn't want to create this appearance that we were in any way working together.
So are you worried that a U.S.-planted fake Twitter will scare off dissidents from using real Twitter in pursuit of freedom and justice around the world?
No, because I think we built a brand, and I think we've built the goodwill over the last 8 years to that shows that we will always try our best to do what's right for the people who use the service.
212-433-WNYC. And Chris in Hillsborough, you're on WNYC with Biz Stone, co-founder of Twitter. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to ask what you think the effect on language, the 140 character limit, has, because I've noticed that grammar has really taken a beating on Twitter.
Well, I mean, my aspiration has always been that constraint would inspire creativity, and that old aphorism of if I had more time, I would have written a shorter letter would force people to be more concise and more almost poetic in their communications. That may not be happening. And of course, you know, text messaging in general, people have started to, you know, condense their words and their language. I'm not a fan of it. I use full sentences. I don't abbreviate. I don't use emoticons.
I'm really sort of an
old school guy.
You?
Yeah.
Should we be surprised by that?
I don't know. I started out as an artist. I've written 3 books. I do a lot of writing in my spare time. I think email should start out with hello, person's name, comma, you know, something. They should be short, but they should be, addressed properly.
Because I could argue it the other way, which is that people are communicating with each other via Twitter, via text. People presumably know what each other mean when they text and all those non-traditionally grammatical ways. But then if they have to step back and write a magazine article or something like that, then they're going to have to use regular grammar because that's what that format, that's what that medium requires.
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. And then you also, you look at these systems like Snapchat where people are literally communicating just with photos. I mean, the conversation goes something like this. Photo? Photo! Photo! I mean, this is what, there's no words. They're just sending each other pictures and they understand what those mean. So maybe you're right. Maybe there is a time and place for every sort of medium and writing, and I'm just too old school here.
Pedro in New Rochelle wants to defend the USAID fake Twitter, I think. Pedro, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to mention that in Cuba there is much demand to exchange information, and that they also use flash memories and CD-ROMs to watch BBC News and other programs that are not accessible to them within Cuba.
Therefore, if the U.S. plants this thing that they can have access to, then much the better because it enhances freedom in Cuba?
Much, much better, yes.
Pedro, thank you very much.
I do agree that people should have a platform for freedom of speech. I mean, this is what I've dedicated my life to building. But to think that you could build it and that it would create, that the technology would then create a revolution of some kind is backwards. It's people that do this. And it's people that will find the right tools, like, you know, water finds the ocean. It's all people. And they'll do like what Pedro just said. You know, they'll record the BBC on CD-ROM. They'll share it around. They'll do whatever it takes. So I believe that people will find a way to communicate and build platforms to do such.
212-433-WNYC. Our very special guest, Biz Stone, co-founder of Twitter. He has a new book called Things a Little Bird Told Me: Confessions of the Creative Mind. You talked before about, with the influence of Bob Vila, creating Twitter for the simplicity of the platform after you were kind of getting turned off by the bells and whistles of your last project, if I can put those words in your mouth.
Yeah.
Now there's a new Twitter redesign which seems to have more bells and whistles and emphasis on photos, larger headers and profile pictures, more choice about placing certain tweets at the top of your timeline, all this, kind of fancification maybe. Any reactions? Does it get away from that ultra-simplistic or simple design that it was founded on?
I think as long as the system fails gracefully all the way down to the simplest of feature phones, then everything is headed in the right direction. If you're on if you're using a really fancy computer, you might as well take advantage of the fact. If you're on a phone that can only handle text messages, in a part of the world where you even get internet connectivity, then a tweet is just the right format. So I think it's, depending on the device that you're on and the connectivity that you have, you may as well take advantage of these things. I mean, people love looking at photos. So by all means, let's share photos.
You use the term fail down.
Yeah, fail gracefully. The fundamental element of Twitter is still the tweet. Everything is sort of attached to that. You have a tweet, and then you may have all this other, what they refer to as metadata, extra information that rides along with the tweet. But if you only have a phone that can only handle text messages, what you'll get is the tweet and none of the other stuff. If you're if you're using Twitter's Macintosh desktop application, you'll get all of this wonderful other things. But as long as it always sort of fails gracefully down to that lowest common denominator, I think the company is headed in the right direction.
One of our listeners who tweets with the handle Donkey Tails asks, why doesn't Twitter make money? Does Twitter not make money?
Twitter makes money through advertising. It just decides to reinvest that money in itself right now. It's not, you know, it's not just building up a giant war chest. It's reinvesting. It's growing. It's, from my perspective, you know, I like to look decades out for this company, because this company just went public. In many ways, it just got its start. Twitter is going to become a timeless company of enduring value, and it should be reinvesting in itself right now. I mean, it's making money, but it needs to grow and build, and there's a lot of work ahead of them.
It did lose money, technically. I looked this up on Mashable today because I wasn't sure. Lost money in 2013 after going public, right?
I don't actually know. I don't work there anymore, and I don't follow the day-to-day. But like I said, I look at this in terms of decades. I mean, you look at a company like Amazon. They often lose money, but they're just an amazing company doing amazing, innovative things. And I don't. It's like when you're trying to lose weight, they say don't look at the scale every day because you'll get disappointed. You got to look at the trend. You know, you have to look at, like, how are you doing over time, and that's the most important thing. Are things moving forward over time? And that's really what you have to look at. You have to take a longer view of a company like this.
You have a chapter in the book called The No Homework Policy, in
yeah.
which you write about deciding in high school that you were too busy to do homework, and you actually announced this to your teachers. Would you tell us that story?
Yeah, I just want to make sure people don't, you know, think that this is just some, like, a punk kid getting away with something. I tried really hard.
Because I have a son in high school who I'm not going to allow to read your book now.
I tried really hard. I got to high school. I actually formed a sports team because I wanted to be on a sports team. I founded a lacrosse team. So I had to go to school, go to sports practice, go to work. I had to work. I got home from work around 8 or 9, and then it was time to do this homework. And I'm not particularly fast at solving math problems or even reading history and English chapters. And so I tried for the first 2 weeks of high school to do everything that was expected of me, and it was taking me till 3, 4 a.m. in the morning. And it just wasn't sustainable, and I wasn't going to quit my sports team. I wasn't going to quit my job. So I just decided that I would be very frank and upfront about it. I went to each of my teachers, and I said, I reintroduced myself. So I said, hello, my name is Ms. Stone. This is your great teacher. This is a great class. Love it. I just wanted to let you know that I'm not going to be doing my homework. But here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pay attention as best as I can in this class, because I know the point of school is to learn. I just can't get the homework done and do everything else. Something has to give. And I sort of universally got laughter from the teachers, I think, because it was just, you know, this freshman high school student being so frank about this. I'm instituting a policy here, you know. They told me, first they laughed, then they told me, well, it's going to affect your overall grade. And I told them I'd be willing to accept that because, you know, I just can't do it. And it worked out really well for me. I don't even know that it did affect my grade overall. But the key, I think, was being very upfront about it. And I wanted to make sure. I said, look, it's not like I'm troubled. I'm not trying to, like, you know, I'm not being a punk. You know, I'm just, this is how my life works, and something's got to give. And so I was very upfront about it, and it worked for me.
Did you study for tests? Did you write papers? Were those exceptions to the policy?
Yes. When there's a big paper, I would write. Of course, I waited until the last minute, but I would always do the big ones. You know, like I did have a class where the entire class was, the whole year was, you have a year to write something, and of course I waited to the day it was due to write it. But, you know, but I would do those big things, of course. Yes, study for tests.
And then you dropped out of college. So you and Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, and do I see a pattern here?
Well, not. I don't think it's for everybody, but you know, I had to make a choice. I had a wonderful scholarship, a full scholarship for excellence in the arts at university, and you know, you can't ask for more than that. And I got this job on the side moving heavy boxes for a publishing company, and one day when the art department, the department that does the book covers, they all went out to lunch, and I was good with Max by that time. I snuck onto their Max, where they were just switching over to from spray glue and X-Acto knives. I snuck onto the art director's workstation, designed a jacket, printed it out, matted it up, and put it in the pile to go off for approval in New York City by sales and editorial. And so when the art director came back, he said, who designed the jacket? And I said, me. And he said, the box kid. And at that point, he offered me a job, and I thought, well, don't people go to university so they can qualify for this kind of job? You know, like, won't I be kind of skipping ahead? And also, I said, wouldn't it be much better to sit here like 8-10 hours a day apprenticing with this master art director? Wouldn't I learn that much more? So I decided, I made a big decision to drop out of college and do just that, sort of basically take an apprenticeship. So that is a wonderful way of learning, and it's maybe not for everybody, but for me, it worked perfectly.
So you're for those freshman basketball players going right to the NBA. No, you don't have to go there.
I actually don't. I don't know anything about sports. But
Really? You who created your own lacrosse team? Isn't that what you said?
Only created my own lacrosse team because I didn't know any. I was in this program called Boy Rangers when I was a kid. My mom put me in this program called Boy Rangers. We had to do various feats of strength to advance from papoose to warrior. It was borderline racist, and so I was in this weird program, and which was father son, and of course my father wasn't there, so it was even more awkward. And as a result, I didn't play Pee Wee soccer or Little League or anything like that. So when I got to high school, I thought, well, I should be on a sports team because that seems like a good way to integrate into the social fabric of high school, and I'm naturally athletic. I tried out for these sports, and I just froze because I realized I have no idea what the rules of any of these these things are. So I did a little research, and I discovered that there was no lacrosse team. So I went to the administration, and I said, if I can get enough kids together and a coach, can I form a lacrosse team? And they said, yeah, if you can do that. And so I did, and the thinking was, if none of us know the rules, then if we're all equally clueless, I don't have to be worried about it. And it turns out I was good at it, and the kids voted me captain, and we were a pretty good team. Looking back, of course, I could have just learned the rules of one of the games, but I didn't realize until just now that could have been a way to go.
I think it's a very telling story. It means you were more an entrepreneur and a community organizer than an athlete.
Well, what I learned from that experience, what I realized looking back upon it later was that a powerful lesson about opportunity, and people often they think about opportunity as the way it's defined, which is a set of circumstances that allow for something to happen. And of course you should think about something as the way it's defined. But if you take a step back and you say, okay, well, the circumstances, you don't have to wait around necessarily for those circumstances to emerge. You can be the architect of the circumstances, which I was. So in other words, opportunity can be manufactured. And that was a really powerful lesson for me to transpose into the business world later on in life.
So last thing, and I think it's related, and my guest has been Biz Stone, co-founder of Twitter, author now of Things a Little Bird Told Me, Confessions of the Creative Mind. And one of your big tips to enhance creativity is what you just said, that opportunity can be manufactured.
Mm-hmm.
But another one is that great work comes from abandoning a linear way of thinking. So can you give everybody the first three steps to abandoning a linear way of thinking? No, that's a joke. But seriously, what does that mean? What did that look like in your case? How can an individual do that as a matter of choice?
Well, it's all about kind of shaking things up and realizing that creativity is a renewable resource, and that you can come at any challenge from infinitely artful approaches. Non-linear thinking is this concept of kind of not approaching something head on, coming at it from the side, taking a break and brainstorming about something completely different, and then thinking, is there some way that these things overlap, and is there taking the opportunity to let your mind kind of float out of your body and be heads in the cloud. I mean, this is one of the core great things about the relationship I have with both Evan Williams and Jack Dorsey, is that they allow me to be in the clouds. If I ask them during a brainstorming session, hey, Jack, let's just assume gravity doesn't exist, he will immediately say, okay, go on. He's not going to say, he won't shut me down, in other words. And so then I can go on, I can say all these crazy ideas, and then the next day he says, you know what, somewhere in there was something that had some merit, and I want to talk more about it. And this is the way that you can come up with really great stuff. I mean, it's not necessarily. I'm not advocating for quitting your job and, you know, doing a startup. I'm just, in any case.
Biz Stone, congratulations on your success, and thanks a lot for talking to us. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, Brian, thanks so much for having me. I did, too.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We begin with New Yorker magazine, Washington editor Ryan Lizza. His article in this week's issue basically declares Chris Christie toast in the presidential campaign. Hi, Ryan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So your article begins
I would quibble with the toast thing, though. We can get into that.
Go ahead. Quibble.
Well, I mean, I don't think he's, you know, I think that the GOP field in 2016 is pretty weak, and everyone's got their issues. So, you know, there's no reason he can't get in there and fight it out. You know what I mean? I think his plan was to enter that race the dominant figure. That is obviously no longer the case, and that's not going to happen. But despite all the challenges and all the issues that he has, I think given that there's no one else in the field that is going to run away with it, I guess I would say it's not. There's no reason for him to completely pack it in.
Oh well,
that was my quibble.
I thought you were characterizing it as toast, and I was going to quibble along the same lines. And even,
Joy Behar in the piece calls him toast.
Yes, right. And we're going to play that clip, but you know, even to say he's being embraced by right-wing talk radio now and people like that because he's got new cred as a victim of the media,
yes,
a victim of the liberal media and the Democratic Party establishment. So a lot of people who on the right who saw Chris Christie as, you know, too liberal for Iowa before are suddenly like, hey, Chris Christie, they're jumping on our guy. It's unfair.
Yes. That is definitely happening. If you look at the polls, his support among Democrats and independents has dropped, but it's partially been made up by increased support among the most conservative voters. I don't know if that's a lasting effect, to be honest, because he governed New Jersey. He had to work with Democrats to get his agenda passed. He doesn't have the kind of true conservative record that some of his opponents have. So, and that was always going to be a problem for him, right? His problem was always going to be ideological in the Republican primaries. The way he was going to compensate for that was to say, hey, we've lost the White House two times in a row here. We're on the cusp of losing the third time. You need to have someone who is electable. So that electability argument was going to be his calling card.
Right. So,
and obviously that's taken a big hit.
The moderate won the Republican primaries the last two times, John McCain and Mitt Romney, you know.
Yes.
So that argument, somebody could shoot that full of holes, too. But I don't want to get
that's true.
Too sidetracked down that rabbit hole. I want to tell everybody that your article begins with this roast of 90-year-old former Governor Brendan Byrne that Christie attended on April Fool's Day in Newark. And I couldn't believe what I was reading. So we went and we actually found audio of what you describe as the most awkward moment in this roast, and we're going to play it in a minute. And I want to set it up by reading a little because the audio is not great. But Christie subjected himself at this thing to liberal comedian Joy Behar and a parade of other wiseacres taking the stage and mocking him over the George Washington Bridge scandal and his weight and going to kiss the ring of right-wing financier Sheldon Adelson in Vegas the other week. Some
yep.
of the lines you printed from various comics, you knew who's asked to kiss. Whatever you say, Sheldon, whatever you say. And someone else, it really is an honor to be standing next to what could be the next president of the – he shuffled some papers on the lectern. I'm sorry, these are the wrong notes. I'm doing a roast next week with Jeb Bush. Ha, ha, ha. And then the Joy Behar moment, this is what you'll hear on the tape, but this is going to help you hear it. When I first heard that he was accused of blocking off three lanes of the bridge, I said, what the hell is he doing standing in the middle of the bridge? And after another barb, Christie interrupted her. This is a burn roast. He stood up and tried to grab her notes. The audience laughed awkwardly. Behar said, stop bullying me. And it goes on from there. So here is about a minute of Joy Behar at this roast, supposedly of Brendan Byrne, in Newark on April 1st. And Christie's response.
Let me take a moment to thank Governor Christie for hosting this event. It was very brave of him. I mean, he's had a few tough, right, sir? Some tough weeks. Don't look at me like that. You're scaring me. First the Velveeta shortage, and now the bridge thing. I mean, it's big. Heard that he was accused of blocking off three lanes on the bridge. I said, what the hell is he doing, standing in the middle of the bridge? I'm killing him. But, you know, you have to have your eye on the White House. It used to be the House of Pancakes, so you're pulled up.
That's where he said, this is a burn roast, and she said, don't bully me. Why don't you get up here at the microphone instead of being such a coward, Joy Behar said, if folks, you couldn't make it out.
He did get up right after that.
How about that? Let me put it to you this way, in a way that you'd appreciate. Your toast. That got pretty rough.
Yeah, this was, and I was very careful in how I wrote about this, because it was one of those events where you're watching it, and it's sort of teetering between being all in good fun and being incredibly awkward and tense.
Yeah.
And I talked to Behar afterwards to sort of get her impression, and she was rattled by the whole thing. I talked to her and her husband, who obviously watches her do these things all the time, said he'd never seen anything like that, and he told me he lost it. And, you know, she was going on about how she thought it was inappropriate and that he was, you know, he had interrupted her act. So, yeah, it was, you know, the
But here's my question for you. A roast is just a roast. So did you publish that story to make a point that if he was still such a formidable presidential candidate, the court jesters wouldn't have dared to be that pointed?
I think that's one thing. What I was trying to set up there is this roast came at a point where he's trying to put everything behind him. He put out this report. He hired some lawyers to write a report. The report came out a couple of weeks ago. It said, oh, he didn't know anything about these lane closures. And their political strategy was to put this whole thing behind them, then go out to Vegas, do his presidential politics thing, kiss the ring of Adelson. And then that kind of didn't go so great because he ended up apologizing to Adelson because he stepped in. He said something that Adelson didn't like.
He said that he referred to the West Bank as the occupied territories.
Right.
Which is not
what
actually
they are and what everyone refers to them as.
Yeah, not a controversial statement in most circles. But
George W. Bush used to use that term. That's what the State Department refers to them as. That's what the UN refers to them as. But among a very, very right-wing pro-Israel crowd that Adelson is represents, they don't. That's not the politically correct term. And Christie ended up having to apologize for that. Right? This is Chris Christie, the big tough guy. He ends up having to apologize for something he believes.
Which is not to say that Israel doesn't have arguments for its position in the Middle East conflict, but by and large, everybody refers to it except a certain conservative,
Adelson, as the
occupied territories.
Yeah, I think Adelson and the Republican Jewish Coalition, which was the crowd he was addressing, their preferred term is disputed territories.
Right.
We don't need to get into all that. So the point of that lead was, all right, things aren't going so well for Chris Christie in the turnaround strategy here. And now instead of, you know, focusing on presidential politics and doing his national campaign, where is he? He's at this low budget roast in Newark, New Jersey, on stage with a bunch of local, you know, largely liberal comedians who are just tearing into him. And he finally, the way I read that is he finally just said, I'm not going to sit here and take this. Usually the script at those things is that if you're a politician, you just sit there and you let the comedians do their thing no matter how bad it gets. I mean, remember when Bill Clinton used to have to go to those political events in Washington where the comedians would get up and make jokes about Monica Lewinsky?
Did they really? I don't remember.
Yeah, in the 90s. I mean, that's the, you know, there are always these political events that where comedians are ripping into the politicians. I've never seen a politician react the way he did.
Much of your article, and we can take calls for Ryan Lizza, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, on the Rose, Christie's prospects, and we'll touch on a couple of other national politics stories like the 2014 midterm elections and maybe the equal pay thing happening in Congress today. Should workers be protected by law in their right to discuss their salaries with their coworkers, compare salaries? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post or tweet at Brian Lehrer for Ryan Lizza this morning. Much of your article is a history of Chris Christie, bully prosecutor, dare I say, including political bullying of people who turned out to be innocent through the federal judicial system as U.S. attorney. Tell me the Joe Doria story.
Well, when Chris Christie was the U.S. attorney from 2002 to 2008, he focused on public corruption, right? And his biggest sting operation involved basically a con man named Solomon Dweck, who, the way I describe it is basically the U.S. attorney in New Jersey, that office unleashed Dweck on Hudson County, and basically Dweck set up meetings with any politician he could and offered them envelopes full of cash to fast-track construction projects. So it was a straight-up bribery sting that Christie was his most famous sting operation. And at a certain point, and this is all very well documented at the time and also in a great book called The Jersey Sting, and frankly, the prosecutors, they wanted the Corzine administration, and they wanted this cabinet member in the Corzine administration named Joe Doria, who they were convinced was corrupt. Frankly, I should add, there's never been any evidence that has come out that Joe Doria did anything wrong. And Dweck tried to bribe Doria unsuccessfully. In fact, Doria once just left a meeting at a diner where Dweck was trying to set him up in a sting. And at the end of 2008, Christie resigns as U.S. attorney, and he runs for governor. In July of 2009, in the middle of that campaign, his former colleagues, the prosecutors in the U.S. attorney's office, pulled the trigger on the sting operation and arrest 44 people on the same day. And the campaign against Corzine, Chris Christie against John Corzine, those arrests instantly became the top issue in the campaign.
So you're saying legitimate arrests, by and large, but
political. Yeah, legitimate arrests. These are politicians that took envelopes of cash.
But politically timed.
This is the great question. I mean, the prosecutors in that office knew that Barack Obama had recently been elected president and a new U.S. attorney would be coming in soon. They didn't wait for that new U.S. attorney to come in and see if he wanted to keep do the case. They didn't wait for the election to be over to pull the trigger on these arrests. They did it in the middle of a campaign, and there's no doubt that doing it helped Chris Christie. One of the people they went after that day was Joe Doria. They didn't arrest him, but they raided his house, and the media watched as the FBI agents brought boxes out of his house. A lot of the boxes were empty because there was no evidence in the house. And that immediately forced Corzine to fire Joe Doria, a top cabinet member. And, of course, that poor guy, his reputation was damaged. It took him several years to finally get a letter from the U.S. attorney saying that he did absolutely nothing wrong. So this, there have been these allegations.
One more. How about the Senator Robert Menendez story?
Well, and this predates that. So this is 2006. Menendez is running against Tom Kaine Jr. Tom Kaine Jr. is the son of Christie's mentor, Tom Kaine Sr., the former two-term governor of New Jersey. They've more recently had a falling out, but back in 2006, he was very close with the Kaines. And Chris Christie subpoenaed Bob, a nonprofit that had ties to Bob Menendez. And the fact that he subpoenaed it was that nonprofit was leaked to the press. And it caused a huge story in the middle of the Menendez-Kaine campaign. Menendez, to this day, hates Chris Christie for this. And Menendez went on to win the campaign, and it took him several years to get a letter from the U.S. attorney saying that the incident was over. There was no wrongdoing. So there was this series of the U.S. attorney going after Democrats in New Jersey at the same time that Chris Christie was very clearly, and this was public knowledge, pursuing the governor's office.
And by the way, listeners, if you want to see that Joy Behar, Chris Christie video, we've now added a link on our website, so you can go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show and feel awkward yourself as an audience member watching that moment. Menendez has other scandal clouds over him, independent of Christie, we should point out.
Yeah, totally separate.
But I was aware at the time of the story that you told, and remember the U.S. attorney scandal, where some of them got fired under President Bush for refusing to mount political investigations of Democratic politicians during election season that year. Well, Christie was one who did against Menendez.
This is very important. I didn't get into this in my piece, but it's very interesting because Christie was – the chronology here is a little cloudy, but – Christie at various times was on the list and off the list of U.S. attorneys that the White House wanted to fire.
Huh.
Some people have speculated, and this is a very murky part of the story, and I looked at this carefully and couldn't figure out the, you know, one way or the other, but some people have alleged that or questioned, oh, hey, did Chris Christie learn that he was on the bad list at the White House? And to get on the good list, did he start doing more high-profile anti-democratic investigations? That allegation has been thrown at Christie for years. He has always said that's not true, and he has always said that if you look at the timing of when he was on the bad list, it doesn't match up with the timing of his most high-profile investigations.
Huh.
But these look,
Menendez
these,
eventually cleared, we should say, of the thing that he was being investigated by Christie for at the time that Menendez was running for office.
Absolutely,
and
right.
that's an interesting detail that you just shared, which I had actually never heard before. I had only
the list
of whether Christie was on the list or off the list of those who would be fired. I was only ever aware of the coincidence or not of the timing.
Yes, he was. So this is an important part of it. He was absolutely on the list of both those that would be fired, and he became aware that he was on that list, and he actually. If you read the Chris Christie biography by Bob Ingle, I-N-G-L-E, it's documented in there. In fact, he was very angry about being on that list, and he tried to get to the bottom of it. He called people at the Justice Department to figure out what was going on. So having learned that, some people have said, well, wait a second, did he try and get off the list by going after this Democrat or that Democrat? But one thing, if you look at that history of how he used his U.S. Attorney's office, It convinced me that there's got to be some rule or cooling off period for U.S. attorneys who want to run statewide for governor or want to run for elective office, because the temptations of that power are just too much. He left at the end of 2008, in the middle of this major sting operation against some of the most important Democrats in the most Democratic county in the state, and then immediately ran for governor. Whether he did anything wrong or not, it just raises conflict of interest questions. And after that happened, a lot of legislators in New Jersey tried to push forward a law that said a U.S. attorney can't run for office until 2 years after they leave.
That's fascinating, that idea of a cooling off period from that office. I mean, if Christie built his reputation as a corruption fighter in corruption-soaked New Jersey, even if he got a few wrong, or we could say push the envelope in a few cases, allegedly.
Yeah, pun intended.
Right. Maybe that was actually a public service for the state, not just a bully's way to rise to power, or maybe some of each.
And that's what he—that's exactly what he has said over the years is, that he had a perfect record as prosecutor. And, the cases were clear. These are people who took cash and promised to do favors. And that all the rest is just whining by Democrats who are defending local corrupt politicians. I will say that the incoming, this is something I didn't mention in the piece, but his successor.
Ooh, we're getting all this exclusive content.
Yeah, exactly.
Didn't make it to the piece.
You're getting the weedy stuff. But Fishman, the U.S. attorney that came after Christie, and the U.S. attorney that right now is the biggest threat to Christie's future because he's investigating Bridgegate. He made a comment publicly back after these arrests that was very critical
of the sting operation that Christie and his colleagues at in the U.S. Attorney's Office pulled off, and he basically said that his comment was something like there was nothing that tied all of the cases together. In other words, you just had this guy Solomon Dweck, who, by the way, later was found to have a long history of mental disorders. You just had this one guy, Dweck, going in and pushing envelopes of cash on local, you know, frankly, low-income politicians, and that there was no larger scheme at play. And that comment was interpreted as Fishman basically saying he didn't really think much of this investigation.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Ryan Lizza, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, for a few more minutes. His article this week, Crossing Christie, What the Bridge Scandal Says About the Governor's Political Style and His Future. 212-433-WNYC. Kylie in Brooklyn, you're on the air. Hey, Kylie.
Hi, how are you all doing?
Good, thank you.
Okay, so this is probably stating the obvious, right? Chris Christie clearly knows all the rules of government. I mean, he went after all these people. I wonder if your guests could speculate, how would Chris Christie, as U.S. attorney, respond to Bridgegate and all of this stuff if he were looking at Sharp James doing it, or Wayne Bryant doing it, or Joe Doria doing it? Like,
Kylie, that is a great, great question.
You sly devil, Kylie.
It really is a great question, because, and I'm not the first person to say this, but if Chris Christie is a very lucky man that Chris Christie is not the U.S. attorney right now, or someone like Chris Christie is not the U.S. attorney right now. Paul Fishman is a very by-the-book, low-profile U.S. attorney. Nobody believes he has any political ambitions. He has not made public corruption his top issue. And I think most people who have looked at this closely would agree that if a prosecutor like Chris Christie were in there, he would be doing everything he could to take down the governor in the wake of this Bridgegate scandal. If it were Corzine, if the shoe were on the other foot and this was Christie going after Corzine, Corzine would be in a lot of trouble. Remember, before Corzine, there was McGreevy, and Christie, as U.S. attorney, investigated McGreevy. He actually had a confidential informant record a conversation with Governor McGreevy, and that investigation was chugging along when McGreevy resigned over a separate scandal, when he told everyone that he was gay and he had a lover who was threatening to out him. At the same time that scandal was going on, Christie's investigation of McGreevy was going on, and a lot of people think that had more to do with his resignation than the other one. So that's a long way of answering Kylie's question, that I think Christie is very lucky that he doesn't have a U.S. attorney who acts the way that he did in there.
By the way, we have a U.S. attorney as our lead guest tomorrow, Preet Bharara. He may cancel after hearing this segment. I don't know. but we're going to run out of time, so we'll do some other Washington politics on another day. But there is no evidence so far that Christie knew about the bridge plot in advance or had any idea that the lane closures were political when he was told on September 11th when they were still going on. You don't believe that's all a lie, do you?
The one piece of information that has come out recently, and to their credit, it was self-reported by the Christie folks, although they dismissed it. David Wildstein, who I think everyone agrees seems to be the driving force behind this thing,
from the Port Authority, Christie's
from
appointee.
The Port Authority, and coincidentally, Christie's who went to high school with Christie. He has apparently alleged that he told Christie something about this at an event on 9/11. Now, we don't know this from Wildstein. We know this, second and third hand from Christie aides who Wildstein told about this. Christie has said he does not remember Wildstein telling him about this, and we really don't know exactly what Wildstein alleges that he told Christie about. So that, of course, if you're Fishman, the U.S. attorney, you're trying to get to the bottom of that. Did Wildstein say, hey, boss, I'm paying back that SOB who didn't endorse you by shutting down lanes in Fort Lee, right? If he said that, that's a big deal. If he said, we're studying some traffic patterns at the bridge, you know, if you read about it, that's what it is. Well, that doesn't really implicate Christie. But that, of course, is the most is the closest that Christie has been tied to contemporaneous knowledge of the closures.
Before you go, you mentioned two books: Bob Ingalls, Chris Christie, The Inside Story of His Rise to Power.
Yes, that's
and
it.
The Jersey Sting by Ted Sherman. Anything else for our Bridgegate Fanatics reading list?
Yes, there's a new book out by a guy named Lou Manzo, who was caught up in one of the Christie stings. He's a Democrat. He's not a fan of Chris Christie, but he's written a very interesting book that gets deep into the issues of whether of how Chris Christie used the office of U.S. Attorney. And I mention it briefly in the piece, but if your readers are interested in this subject, Manzo has a sort of PhD on this at this point, and his book is very interesting.
Called Set the Record Straight. Is that the same thing?
I think it's called Naked Ambition.
Okay, by Manzo.
Naked Ambition. I think it's called, the subtitle is The Rise and Fall of Chris Christie.
And again, listeners, we posted that video of Joy Behar roasting Chris Christie at a Brendan Byrne event in Newark on April 1st, and Christie getting up out of the audience and all of that, which is...
Or he was on the dais. He was standing right next to the podium, so it wasn't
right.
as dramatic as getting up out of the audience.
Okay, great. But as
that would have been something.
Yeah, even more of a something. As described by Ryan Lizza at the beginning of his article in this week's New Yorker, Crossing Christie, What the Bridge Scandal Says About the Governor's Political Style and His Future. See that video at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Ryan, thanks a lot. Good talk.
Hey, good talk to you.
Brian Lehr on WNYC. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.